Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, who was Osama bin Laden really? Apparently not who we think he was. In 2002, a journalist freelancing for CNN discovered some 1,500 tapes that had been housed in Osama bin Laden's home in Kandahar, Afghanistan. The tapes contained conversations, speeches, and other revealing material about bin Laden and also about al-Qaeda. After a comprehensive study of the tapes' contents, linguistic anthropologist Flag Miller has concluded that the real Osama bin Laden does not comport with the myth. Flag Miller joins us now. He's a professor at the University of California, Davis, and the author of The Audacious Ascetic, What Osama bin Laden's Sound Archive Reveals About Al-Qaeda. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Flag Miller. It's great to have you here with us.
Great to be here.
This audacious ascetic, Osama bin Laden, there have been these 1,500 tapes that have been discovered. Now, first of all, I understand these were discovered by a freelance journalist. Is that right?
By a stringer, a CNN stringer with a camera crew who was working in Kandahar, and he himself is Afghani, and he was actually been a photographer for the Taliban for years before. So, yes.
And what happened with these tapes? They went to CNN first. What has been the traveling diary of these 1,500 tapes?
Yes, it's an unusual story. They were acquired by a local Afghan family after the Taliban fell in December of 2001, just a few months after 9/11. The city had been the headquarters for the Taliban in southeastern Afghanistan and also bin Laden, where he had really led al-Qaeda's most coherent organizational momentum in the years before 9/11. Bin Laden had been in the city from 1997 to 2001, and he had a house that was in downtown Kandahar. So the house was ransacked after the Taliban fell. From what I gather, the local Afghan family had gone into the house afterwards and discovered this set of tapes that were sitting untouched in a corner of the house, and thought of the first person they thought of was some kind of relative of the family who ran a local Pashto pop song shop, and thought these tapes would be useful for blunt expert, you know.
They'd be useful for what?
They thought the tapes would be useful for blanks, just to record over on, and they were shipped to this pop song shop, and that's when the CNN stringer, also Afghani, heard about this and went over to the shop and said, wait, you know, these are of interest to a larger community, and so CNN purchased the tapes. And, you know, I've talked with the stringer, and he told me how they got them to their office in Pakistan in Islamabad, and then from there, the FBI and CIA reviewed the tapes. From what I hear, they didn't take any and declined stewardship. Indeed, the tapes were, I guess, considered of largely historic value and not about imminent security threats. And so CNN ended up selling the tapes to Williams College, where there was a Williams Afghan Media Project that was known in Afghanistan for helping restore the royal family to photography archives, and it's also known in the States. And so the tapes ended up at Williams College in 2003, and that's when I got the call from a colleague there who works in an anthropology department. I'm an anthropologist by training, and my specialization was Yemen and bin Laden's ancestral homeland and the tapes and their use for political and religious. And so I got involved from off the bat.
So did you have a sense that these tapes were actually made by Osama bin Laden, or were they made by somebody else for him?
You know, I've spoken with bin Laden's son, who was Omar bin Laden, who was with his father all the way through that period. He defected from al-Qaeda in 2000 and then found asylum in Western countries. So I had a number of interviews with him. He talked to me about his dad's use of the tapes. And the tapes are not mostly by bin Laden. There are 24 tapes that feature his voice, and those stretch from the late 1980s through 2001. But the vast majority are other cassettes that were recorded by other people, and they 200 other speakers, almost all of them speaking in Arabic. And they are prominent culture scholars. I am not.
I got most of what you said there about how you had interviewed Osama bin Laden's son who had defected from al-Qaeda. and you were just getting into where you thought the origin of the tapes were.
Most of these tapes were not made by bin Laden. Only 24 of the tapes feature him speaking at all. Those tapes date from the late 1980s through 2001. The vast majority of the other tapes, all the other tapes feature others speak, hundreds of them from across the Arabic-speaking world. And they are Saudi scholars, well-known scholars of Islamic law, mostly from the Middle East and the Arabian Peninsula. Many of them are kind of commercially produced sermons that feature a wide range of topics, the kind of things Arab Afghans would have been listening to at the time, not only for kind of tactical training, but really for moral instruction and kind of thinking through the complexities of the politics and the use of violence in Islamic context. But there's a good 10% of that material is also very amateur recordings of everyday people in the training camps and other contexts around in Kandahar who are speaking in Arabic and sometimes chatting about quite ordinary everyday things like getting food on the table or getting across town in a taxi cab or just having conversations about world affairs, singing songs, all kinds of curious recordings that shed a lot of light on what was really going on under Al-Qaeda's roof in this time.
So really there could have been multiple people who were taping various aspects of life there. We just don't know for sure.
Yes. There are many, many different...
And then gathered and put in one place.
And they all ended up in kind of a collective lending library, is the way I think we can conceptualize this. It was in bin Laden's house, but people would come in, they would loan bin Laden tapes, they would probably borrow tapes. So it was definitely a kind of an organic, live collection until the day that it was acquired. And then, you know, the process of archival research began.
A couple of the things that I found particularly interesting throughout your book dealt with the meanings of the word Al-Qaeda specifically, sort of as a base away from corruption or something to that effect. How would you describe how the words Al-Qaeda were used mostly throughout that tape?
So in Arabic, Al-Qaeda means a base or a rule, like a rule of inference, mostly in discussions of what are the bases or the rules of inference in Islamic law. Jurisprudence and legal scholars have for centuries gathered these rules or bases for understanding how debates in Islamic courts should be manage, for example, innocent till proven guilty. That's levar or levarar in Arabic. And that just means that, you know, that is a rule, everybody knows it, that can be applied. The thing about rules is that for the scholars is that there are always exceptions to the general rules, as there are in any legal system. So you kind of go in, want to apply a certain rule, but there are contexts, there are mitigating circumstances that qualify. Now, to know how qualified have to have your training and scholarship to know that. And what brings us back to kind of the Al-Qaeda that we're familiar with in the West is that bin Laden, you know, for him, that was the world of the Qaeda he knew best. And it was grounded in Islamic law, debates also about theology, even Arabic language. And he would begin to make arguments, he and his supporters began to make arguments that they were best qualified to know what the exception for to Islam, long-held rules. And that's where we begin to see some radical interpretations. My book explores the ways in which those interpretations are brought. The bigger the debate in the West about this organization called Al-Qaeda that bin Laden ostensibly ran and had founded and financed, I don't hear that idea of Al-Qaeda anywhere on the tape, except for one tape that's produced in late 2000, well after that idea had risen in the West. And, you know, it's kind of an Al-Qaeda branding, like a propaganda tape made at a wedding. But all the other tapes, I don't find the idea of Al-Qaeda as we associate it in the West, that is this kind of organization run by bin Laden with militant objective to, you know, take on authoritarian leaders, especially in the West and the United States. So So when I came to the tapes, I heard that. I heard so many of these other contexts, and I began to write about why it was that there was this gap in translation, in perspectives, and how these very different worlds ended up coming together.
Let's go to that idea of asceticism versus this media machine and fitting all that together.
Right. In the summer of 1996, Bin Laden really reached world audiences like never before. It was when he gave a speech that became known as his declaration of war against the Americans occupying the two holy places. And those are Saudi Arabia's Medina and Mecca, two holy cities for Muslims. And it's through that speech that he became known in the West as someone who wanted to take on the United States explicitly. It was at that point really that his media machine really took off, and it took off kind of across the globe as worlds, especially television networks, began interviewing him like never before. What I show in my book, though, is that he came into the media attention precisely at the weakest point of his career. He had lost all his money by that time, by August of 1996. And through poor investments in the Sudan, he'd lost hundreds of millions. His inheritance and assets had been stripped of him by his family, by this Saudi state in 1994. He'd been made citizenless. He'd been made stateless, kicked out of the Sudan just a month earlier. And he was a pariah, and numerous assassin teams had kind of gone after him, most likely sponsored by Saudis, Yemenis, Muammar Gaddafi, Libya, all of whom knew that Bin Laden, was supporting insurgencies against them. And so when Bin Laden had nowhere else to go and nobody who would fund him, that's when he turned to the West in hopes of becoming, their number one enemy. So what I talk about in the book is the way he used asceticism to his advantage in playing on the Western media's fears. He represented himself as a kind of guy who had left his family of his multi-million dollar, the Bin Laden Group family, and he had taken this more austere path that was toward the virtues of armed militancy against worldly corruption. And yet he, within Islam, any discourses of asceticism through history have been primarily about the inner enemy, not the foreign enemy, as it became known in the West, that is, the United States and Western interests. Within Islam, asceticism, zuhd, is about taking on the internal enemy, and that is an enemy that's tempted toward worldly accumulation and desire. And it's the Muslim self that is the primary target for that kind of wrath. And so for most Muslims, that was the primary struggle. Bin Laden had come to power by tapping on movements within the Islamic world that were devoted primarily to supporting insurgencies against perceived corrupt Muslims themselves. And those included the top state leaders such as Saddam Hussein. They included, the Saudis and others. They included Shiites above all. This was mostly a Sunni movement. And I talk about how Al-Qaeda, the first base established in the Arab world that many came to kind of think of as Bin Laden's animal, was actually a specific base camp in Afghanistan called Al-Farouk base camp, set up in the late 80s. And its primary goals were to support Muslim insurgencies within the Islamic world, not to take the fight to the far enemy, the West. So Bin Laden, was primarily seen as that kind of guy. But at his wit's end, with nowhere to turn to and no credibility, he then moved to the West and said, well, actually, my asceticism is going to be against, you know, the world's most powerful economic superpower, and that is the United States. And he pitched himself very much as now targeting the U.S. But that was a message that many of his supporters felt like was too far-fetched, was not something they were willing to put their efforts into. Most of his supporters, most of the training camp people in Afghanistan, Arab Afghans, were really committed to more local insurgencies and revolution at home. And so bin Laden was really invested in trying to build his image in the West as someone who could do that. And it worked well, that is, who could take on the West. And that message worked well because Western journalists at the time were looking for a story about why should the United States get more involved with Iraq, more involved with military actions against Saddam Hussein. The story of America's controversial role in Iraq with sanctions, internationally supported sanctions and so forth at the time was one that news networks were looking to say, and political, you know, the executive branches in the United States were looking for a story about kind of why does the United States need to worry about, you know, Saddam's capacities to threaten the United States? And the answers were partly weapons of mass destruction. As we know, there were none. But behind that was this murky al-Qaeda network that was ostensibly led and funded by bin Laden. But as I say in my book, in historical hindsight, that was a non-entity in the mid-90s.
Because he had lost so much of his wealth, or because they...
He had lost his wealth, so he did not have the financial means to support a kind of pan-Islamic network of that sort, or one that could deliver the kind of threat force that was news networks were saying and intelligence sources were saying that he could deliver. And then also, he was not seen as a credible figure in the Arab world, someone who could lead a base camp, lead an al-Qaeda, because he was not a person with military training. He was, you know, son from one of 53 siblings in an immense, wealthy Saudi family. And he didn't also have a religious training. So he, you know, was a civil engineer. So he wasn't seen as someone who had either the military or religious credibility to be able to lead, you know, a base of the sort or a network of the sort he was held to represent in the West. So it was really, you know, where that idea of him as that kind of leader emerged was in courtrooms in the United States in the mid-1990s as federal prosecutors, U.S. federal prosecutors, sought to build a case for a larger network of terror that lay behind the 1993 World Trade Center bombing attack. That attack was sponsored mostly by Egyptians. Bin Laden was not involved, but National Security Advisor Anthony Lake and other chief prosecutors said, we want to find a network, and we suspect bin Laden's behind it. At the time, the CIA said, no, we don't think there's evidence for that. But prosecutors and national security folks said, well, let's dig deeper, right? So the news networks kept coming back to him and to bin Laden and saying, well, okay, maybe you aren't directly involved in that attack, but what about the 95 bombing of the National Guard headquarters in Saudi Arabia? What about the 1996 Khobar Towers bombing? You know, you were involved with those, were you not? As it's been said in the West, and bin Laden was not involved. You know, history says he was not involved with those attacks, but he was wanting to play up his capacity to deliver exactly that kind of thing, because it was his last chance, and so he said, you know, he began to take credibility for those attacks. And of course, because of the urgency with which many felt political pressure, and militarization in Iraq needed to be ramped up to help resolve the controversial role the U.S. played in the region, Bin Laden became a poster boy for the kind of interventions that were later seen as necessary.
When we come back, how do the 1,500 tapes discovered in Osama bin Laden's home contradict Western myths about who the man was and about the organization Al-Qaeda? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been talking about how do the 1,500 tapes discovered in Osama bin Laden's home contradict Western myths about who the man was and about the organization Al-Qaeda. With us is Professor Flagg Miller. So would you say in doing this study that the image of Osama bin Laden as the leader of Al-Qaeda is a creation of a publicity machine and then an American media at the same time?
Yeah, it's a convergence very much of multiple kind of media interests represented by multiple states, Bin Laden was a convenient, the Bin Laden, there's the Bin Laden the guy, and then there's the Bin Laden phenomenon, right, who's kind of a media sensation and a story. And that they're to be separated. I talk a lot about my book about how Bin Laden, the man himself, was very much kind of the subject of, in that larger story. But he also was himself kind of followed that story very carefully. He was fascinated about who are people saying I am? And he would constantly be listening to CNN. He'd have CNN running full time on his training in his guest houses in Kandahar and elsewhere, because that was the most coherent story of the Bin Laden phenomenon that anybody could find. And so, I think many books have been written about Bin Laden, the man, and other books written about the phenomenon, and the media sensation. But my book really, it brings those together precisely because I'm working with this real-time transcript of audio from late 60s all the way up to after 9/11 that tells us and shows us the debates that were going on about what is Al-Qaeda, what is Bin Laden. There was by no means consensus on what it was. And how did that evolve over time?
So let's go to that a little bit, too, since these tapes do go so far back. How do all of these tapes together suggest that Al-Qaeda actually emerged? And then from the emergence, did Osama bin Laden fit into that, what it was becoming, or did he take it in a different direction?
Well, so bin Laden's first militant activity is recorded on one of these tapes in the collection. It's a tape that features some people talking on walkie-talkies, and they're in Arabic. And one of them's nicknamed Abu Kaka, and that's bin Laden's nickname. And the guy speaking as Abu Kaka, his voice is very much bin Laden's. And he's kind of giving directives to a few other Arab Afghans who were actually in the act of a militant operation. That's a bombing operation. And then you hear some celebration, then you hear, people saying, yeah, it's been exploded. And we learn that it's a Soviet warehouse that is in Afghanistan. and they take great, they celebrate the fact that it's been blown up. This was part of a small group of Arab Afghans who were working under the Afghan Mujahideen at the time in the late 1980s. And they had set up a small camp called the Lion's Den, as it was known, about 6 miles across the border from Pakistan. And it was a relatively insignificant military operation, but Bin Laden, nevertheless, that was his one and only time on the front lines, and he recorded it on tape in order to take it back to home audiences and represent himself as the big man in this fight. Of course, he had a lot of money, so he was appreciated at that time for supporting the Arab Afghans. But he was not, as I say, a militant leader of any credibility or religious scholar. The first base, Al Qaeda, that was set up, that's the original base from which, you know, later the myths arose of Bin Laden's leadership, was in Afghanistan, a few miles away from that Lion's Den camp, and it was run by North Africans, especially Egyptians, such as Ayman al-Zawahiri and others. They were the chief leaders. Their primary goal was to bring revolution, the Islamic revolution, from Afghanistan, and bring it after the Soviets had left Afghanistan in 1989. They said, well, now what? Well, we're going to bring all of our training back to the Middle East to overthrow corrupt regimes at home. Bin Laden tried to be a part of that camp, but he was marginalized explicitly. In the training camp documents that are now at West Point and that many people point to as Al-Qaeda's founding charter, what we see is that it's a very general charter setting up a number of committees, military committees, financial wing, media wing, and so forth. But there's a clause in there that says none of the emir of the camp's bodyguards can be from Yemen or Saudi Arabia. And it's a very puzzling clause, because all of Bin Laden's guys, all of his support team, all of his closest bodyguards, they were all from the Saudi Arabia and Yemen. So that clause, I came across that. I'm thinking, well, if this is Al-Qaeda's charter, why is someone like Bin Laden marginalized explicitly? Well, the answer is that Saudi money for these guys, Farouk, the true kind of militant socio-revolutionaries, Saudi money was always seen as welcome, but came with strings attached. The strings were, here's a lot of money to go, support conservative and militant causes around the world, but don't bring that back home. We don't want you bringing revolution back home. And that was not the message that those base commanders at the Al-Qaeda wanted. And so so they explicitly had to marginalize Saudis and did so like that. The story then emerges over the book, well, then how did Bin Laden come to, acquire this reputation for leading Al-Qaeda? And as I show in the book, there were attempts that he made in his guest house in Peshawar to set up a kind of headquarters. Again, he didn't have a whole lot of leverage compared with all the other major figures in that town. He went to the Sudan, tried to set up some base camps there, but really is the Egyptian Islamic Jihad that was far more powerful and could mobilize the resources in Sudan and Egypt that, his money was welcome, but he was also held at arm's length with regards to tactical and strategic goals. The story is that he's seeking to try to brand himself as a base commander. He uses some of those documents from the Al-Farouk base camp in order to try to manipulate them and edit them to try to represent himself as the guy who could do it. But again, the place where he really gained credibility and could begin to play this role was not in in the Arab world among Arabic speaking, supporters, because he was so controversial. Rather, it was in the West, where he, especially if he could be representative, someone the West really needed to worry about.
A few things in this that I think come up. One is, A, he was really a publicity hound. B, mm-hmm. We misunderstand al-Qaeda in the West. We still do.
Yes. I mean, we have the sense that it's a kind of an organization with a clear ideology and a clear hierarchical structure of command. I think perhaps now more than ever, it's becoming clear that that's a troubled image. I mean, there's a whole opposition front in Syria right now that's called al-Qaeda, right? That's what the West frequently refers to this, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the kind of salvation front, that they are in many of the cities that Bashar al-Assad went after, the state leader of Syria, through killing campaigns and chemical weapons. So all kinds of groups there now struggling under the Islamist label but they're called al-Qaeda, as if it's a single kind of group. So too in Yemen now, another major branch of al-Qaeda. I think what there's very different groups, and that the thing that I'm constantly reminded of when listening to these tapes and how Arabic speakers talk about militancy and the kind of role that Islam can play in lending moral and ethical guidelines to people in context of violence. The thing I'm always reminded of is the ways in which, al-Qaeda is always rooted within local struggles. And yes, there are global factors involved and global histories in the U.S. and the West. And those are very important. But when it comes to kind of thinking about, is there a single ideology, for example, unify under a caliphate, worldwide? Is there an apocalyptic vision that the apocalypse is nigh and we all have to get our, values in order? Okay, yes, those larger, like dystopian or utopian frameworks are there, or, ultimate political solutions, right? But what do people really care about? And so often you see, okay, you can pick out the sound bites as people float those ideas, but what are the people talking about most of the time? Most of the time they're talking about, well, who's sitting next to me in this room? Who can bring resources to the table to address this particular issue in this village, or, with regards this particular battle that's happening 2 miles away? That's the nature of most of the debate that goes on under al-Qaeda's, rubric. If you put that into Arabic, it's a base, but it's what kind of base? Which territories does it actually have? Like what are the actual ideologies involved? Is it all Islamic, or is it partly nationalism? Or is it partly ethnic, or is it tribal? Those are equally valuable and important parts of any discussion that, it begins to become the al-Qaeda that the West typically identifies as becomes a black box.
And the evolution that you've found through, A, the sort of putting side by side Osama bin Laden's speeches and what would follow that, did you see that he had a specific contribution to the changing nature of al-Qaeda? Like, would it have focused, for example, on the West at all, on this, what they called, I think, the anti-crusader, anti-Jewish occupation? Would that have even come to pass if it weren't for Osama bin Laden? Was that his contribution?
So bin Laden, that's a great question. Bin Laden, I mean, the short answer is no, because bin Laden was a uniquely cosmopolitan guy who could also who also had experience in Afghanistan as a militant. And he was a broker, you know, not only economically, but he could be seen as a cultural, a guy who was both from a thoroughly Americanized family, you know, but also someone who represented a kind of an Arab core. And he was able to kind of move across both of those identities in a way that that others couldn't. So, you know, when it came to representing himself as intimate enough with the West that mattered, he could do that, and people would look to him in Afghanistan and elsewhere and say, "Well, gosh, you know, if he's saying that he can, you know, that he can take on the West and can do that, well, he has the kind of contacts within the West, you know, to be able, you know, maybe their militant contacts, maybe their corporate contacts, you know, that he can kind of pull that off. Or conversely, if separation from the West and becoming the West's ultimate enemy is really what's to his advantage, he can do that, because he is of this Arab, you know, family. And, his father helped restore, you know, Jerusalem's most sacred mosque on the nearest mosque, as it's called, Masjid al-Aqsa, as well as a number of other sites in the Arab world in the 60s and 70s. So he kind of had a cultural prestige there for Arabism, but he didn't fit clearly into the categories that people in the Middle East thought of as the clear leader for Islam, for example, or for a militant cause, or for you know, a political movement. He was you know, weak. He was somehow compromised on all those various fronts, and for that reason, he could kind of begin telling stories about how he could move across all those domains in kind of unparalleled ways, and no more so than in Western, you know, in the Western media that wanted to find an enemy or an adversary who could cross national borders so easily, who could morph from a state leader like Saddam Hussein into something that was far more disparate and faceless. Like weapons of mass destruction. Bin Laden could kind of represent the fear of moving across those traditional identity categories or those traditional, you know, groups and become the network that especially money and weapons seemed to catalyze. And because he was from this multimillionaire family that was, it wasn't traditionally tribal in the ways many Saudi families have been. He didn't have the kind of tribal prestige and authority that existed in Saudi Arabia or would make him actor. That he was kind of a magical self-made entrepreneur, you know, socially, economically, and you know, so it's that kind of very interesting, certainly, you know, kind of positionality that made him the figure he was, at least in kind of you know, the stories of fear mongering and terror that really he came to play in very much in the late 90s and up to 9/11.
It does seem, however, that one of the roles that he did play was focusing more of this attention onto the West than had been previously focused by al-Qaeda. It seems like he had a role in making that more prevalent. Would you say that's the case?
He was certainly, you know, willing to go there. I think that, you know, his ultimate, like the earliest tapes in this collection show him how, show that his primary investments were wanting to purge the House of Saud of its corruption. So his own homeland, the Saudi family, like, and also purged the Arabian Peninsula of communists, Shiites, and Arab socialists. Like, those were the triumvirate. That was the worst of the worst for him. Now, when he faced struggles doing that and was ultimately exiled, stripped of his money, you know, made a pariah, stripped of his citizenship. That's when he turned and really ratcheted up the anti-West rhetoric. And it was precisely at a time that, again, this issue about the U.S. involvement in Iraq and why U.S. needed to get more involved was very paramount. And so, you know, I think that his anti-American bent was a convenience for him, but it was also a message that transcended him. It was by no means his message, but he was willing to play that part because others needed that message.
And so then he got to enjoy the infamy, even though it wasn't fully his. When we come back, how do the 1,500 tapes discovered in Osama bin Laden's home contradict Western myths about who the man was and about the organization Al-Qaeda? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been talking about how do the 1,500 tapes discovered in Osama bin Laden's home contradict Western myths about who the man was and about the organization Al-Qaeda. With us is Professor Vlad Miller, who's towards the end of your book. This might have been among the wedding, reciting some of the sayings from Islam, and so much of it is about humility. And yet he came across as so arrogant. It was just interesting to try to reconcile that.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Abu Walid al-Masri and Mustafa, two of his kind of aides-de-camp at the time, Abu Walid al-Masri and also the Syrian Abu Musab al-Suri, they very much wrote and reported about how bin Laden was kind of caught up with the flash of screens and that he was losing sight of what all of them had been working for years, which was, you know, Islamic reform among state regimes at home and kind of cultural transformation back in the secular Muslim world. So, you know, they saw him as a deeply, you know, kind of veering off toward that sense of his own kind of media power and in very disturbing ways. They talk about that. After the African bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania in 1998, in August of 1998, there were strikes. Clinton launched cruise missile strikes into Afghanistan, the training camps there. At that point, you know, Afghanistan faced being attacked. Mullah Omar, you know, faced being attacked in his land in the name of bin Laden. At that point, Mullah Omar, whereas months before he'd been working with other Taliban leaders to think about handing bin Laden over, at that point he very much came to bin Laden's vocal defense. And bin Laden then rose to world media attention as this, as the guy who pulled off those attacks and could mobilize threats of that sort. And at that point, money started to move toward him for a lot of different reasons. So his financial capacities before 9/11, of course, grew. He was then involved with these training camps that trained none of the 9/11 hijackers and was able to kind of pull in dollars through donors and such to finance those. So, but again, that was a function of the bin Laden phenomenon. and what it was doing globally, as much as the man. The reason I say that is, for example, you know, in Saudi Arabia, for example, like, why would someone want to be contributing to that anti-American message? Well, because, for example, the Saudi state or the Qatari state or a number of the Gulf states, they, you know, we're living in, I mean, in that period in the mid-1990s, there were periods of turmoil, political turmoil. In Qatar, for example, there was a coup. And when that kind of thing happens and families are jockeying for power, the family in power will say to its opponents, okay, look, we're not going to do the things we used to, like corruption and, you know, and just catering to the West and Western interests. We will actually support Islamic reform. We will support radical, you know, conservatism, including various militant groups. But we're going to do that not within our own borders. We'll channel money across our borders to movements of that sort that are doing good, but not here in the homeland. We're going to, you know, because they don't want that arrest in home. So Bin Laden kind of became someone that, for state leaders or people in positions of power within states, would be, you know, a key recipient for helping states placate their opposition movements. And that was kind of part of the logic that Bin Laden played upon in order to draw money his way.
Given what you have shown us about myth versus reality, public image versus private person, through these translations, if we were going to take what we've learned about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and put them into today's context with the Islamic State, would you say there are lessons for us to learn?
Absolutely. You know, history repeats itself. And, you know, at this point, we're looking at people right here in my home state of California who, you know, commit kind of mass killings, gun spree, and then post a Facebook page that's, you know, pledges oath to ISIS, and then that kind of become ISIS's capacity to deal, you know, death kind of worldwide, mass, you know, once again we're getting kind of the idea of mass death, and the kind of ways in which an event like that and, you know, the image of a kind of network of radicalized Muslims who have the financial and global capacities to bring down states becomes very much part of what people remember as part of something that happened once. Maybe the state that brought down was Saddam, and maybe it wasn't by, you know, bin Laden, or, you know, maybe it was U.S. intervention, but that was to respond to al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, in 2003, or wait a minute, maybe al-Qaeda wasn't in Iraq before 2003. So, you know, there's a whole lot of emotions that get picked up in a narrative that, you know, can often seem so clear. The clear enemy is ISIS, like world leaders, everybody kind of talking about ISIS as that ultimate evil that must be confronted, much in the same way that al-Qaeda was spoken about, you know, in before 9/11, in a way that ultimately bin Laden took advantage of in building his threat capacities, and replicating the 93 World Trade Center bombing in 2001, because that's what was kind of expected. And so, you know, the danger is that we get, we kind of lose the, you know, forest for the trees, and, you know, being so unfamiliar, as many Americans are so unfamiliar with Muslims generally. How many Americans know a Muslim? Very few. Much less Islam and its place in the world as a religion. You know, that is most of the discussions about Islam in context or violence are not support of violence. Most of them are, this is how, you know, violence does not work, and the evils of it. So, but those are the discussions that really, you know, the qualifications of violence that happens in discussion among Muslims when they're talking about religion, among many other things, are not the kind of things that we often hear. So, yeah, I think this lesson is very much one of, well, we need to be thinking about the stories we tell, because they can come back to haunt us.
And I think it also is reflective of how mass media framing and people's desires for a simple answer can feed into actually creating an evil being where it may not really exist.
Right. I mean, the thing about terror is that it works kind of beyond fact and what actually exists. It works. That's precisely it. It terrifies us far beyond its actual threat capacities, its actual factual, you know, the factual numbers that are of innocent people that are killed in a given attack and so forth. That so terror works, you know, precisely because there's something about it that taps into a far deeper and amorphous set of fears, and what they are, we can't put our thumb in it, which is precisely why it's so scary. You know, is this the kind of killing that resembles so many of the other, mass killings that are motivated by, you know, white supremacists or high school, you know, kids who are just pissed off, or, you know, racial killings of black men in streets who are, you know, holding up their hands. So that kind of thing, you know, that's much trickier because we know a lot about those contexts. We have neighbors and friends who resemble those people but are not those people. Whereas when it comes to Islam, not many Americans have those friends and neighbors. And so it's just easier to be able to make, you know, turn things a darker shade of gray.
Flag Miller, I thought maybe we should also touch on some of the lighter note through some of the tapes, which are the quirky pieces of Osama bin Laden. What were some of those quirks?
So a number of these tapes feature quite eclectic material. We don't, including anthems, singing, trivia show, trivia contests between participants. It's hard to say where they are, but they're kind of in guest houses. And we don't know actually which of these tapes bin Laden himself listened to, but what we do know is that the world of people that he frequented, I mean, as our Arab Afghans in Kandahar, they had, they were from many different national backgrounds, many different ethnic, backgrounds, Arabic speaking by and large, but, these tapes reflect the kind of, heteroglot, pluralistic world of the Arab Afghans. There's one tape, for example, that features a Jewish Algerian singer, Gaston Granacia, otherwise known as Enrico Macias. Why would that tape? You know, he's singing in French because he was an Algerian Jew who left for France and after the revolution in Algeria and became world famous. Why would that tape be there? And probably because, you know, one of the Arab Afghans that bin Laden knew, you know, was Algerian or French or knew, had this history, and he enjoyed the songs and, you know, but perhaps, I mean, these militants, they led multiple lives, and part of what made jihad and made, you know, kind of their path toward militancy meaningful was a struggle with themselves, with their former selves or with people they knew. So, you know, whether that tape was something that they listen to in order to kind of, you know, in their moments of kind of dark desire, and then they would purge themselves, or whether it was something they still continue to enjoy and, you know, and say, well, you know, that aside, I can still, you know, I can still fight the fight. It's hard to say, but certainly the tapes can convey the human aspects of the many voices that would have filled, you know, debate rooms under al-Qaeda's roof in ways that, you know, we have yet to understand.
Something that you said toward the end of the book was it's about the medium itself and how the tapes and the audiences for which they were made might actually produce something different when you analyze those versus analyzing other types of materials. What did you mean by that?
So, I mean, yeah, so this stuff is sound, and how infrequently we're able to actually hear extended conversations among people affiliating with al-Qaeda. you know, and they're in other, maybe they're in other languages, so maybe we're not, you know, we don't have those languages. My book, incidentally, is accompanied by a website, audaciousascetic.com, that allows non-Arabic speakers all the translations in my book, along with the real-time audio, so that they can follow and listen and understand what the debates are and what, and so, but to be able to hear extended discussions, I think is really important, because so often what we receive of Bin Laden sound bites or Al Qaeda sound bites are highly selected and edited pieces, just snippets that are really meant to be part of a larger message. And, you know, without being able to, for example, situate a comment about, you know, a threat about, against, you know, a given country in relation to other threats that are made in the same speech against other actors, other countries, you know, and to be able to kind of assess, what do people in this larger sermon or speech that Bin Laden will give, what are the main issues here, and you know, without being able to, you know, take in that the larger part of what's actually spoken conversation and oral exchange, we're left with, you know, a kind of a mirror of what we're supposed to think, right? And that is often something that we get in the global sound bites, whether they're on television or in the newspapers or so forth, because of so much of the way the message driven nature of news stories.
Thank you so much for being with us, Flag Millard.
Always a pleasure, as always.
Flag Millard's a professor at the University of California, Davis, and the author of The Audacious Ascetic, What Osama Bin Laden's Sound Archive Reveals About Al-Qaeda. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.